Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to Lost in Science. It is the science where you get lost and you wonder how whether you'll ever get out of it. And turns out you probably won't. Because it's science is all around us. Is that right, Claire?
That is right. But maybe less threatening. Maybe it's sort of like a lovely warm bath rather than fiery pits, or you know, or an awful bog or quicksand or whatever.
And maybe after this half hour you'll feel a little less lost. You'll be still in the science, but you won't feel as lost. Claire, what have you got for us today?
Well, speaking of woods and forests and getting lost in them, I have a story from the wild rainforests of Sumatra, and a particular animal that lives there, of course, the orangutan.
Ooh.
Yeah. And some fascinating research that is right up my alley. So here I'm about to tell you, Chris, about an orangutan that has been documented applying medicinal plants to its own wounds.
What?
So yeah. I guess you'd call that self-medicating, or like, you know, an orangutan first aid kit. I don't know what you would call it, but it isn't just humans that do it. It is some of our other great ape friends, colleagues, kin. And yeah, I'm going to tell you all about it, what it is, who this orangutan is, because I know you want to meet him.
Did they have flanges, this particular orangutan?
It did have flanges.
Excellent. I love it, a flange.
Yep. So we'll talk about those flanges as well, obviously. Great. We can't do an orangutan story without talking about flanges.
Brilliant. And we will also have Stu presenting a story. Stu talking to myself and Kat, that's our Kat Triona, not meow, Kat, about cannonball or artillery fungus. And these are fungi that are very common, apparently, all over the place, but they are causing some consternation to homeowners because, as the name might suggest, they fire things at houses. And, causing some concern. So Stu will tell us all about the cannonball fungus and what's it about and why you should not be scared of this artillery in your garden. So that's all coming up today. Let's get on with the show.
Well, Chris, this week on the show, we're swinging into the treetops and we're joining some of our closest relatives in the animal kingdom, the orangutan, because these magnificent apes, they've just been documented displaying an incredible new trick, or maybe not trick, sort of skill, I guess you would call it. They've been observed using medicinal plants to treat their wounds. Actually, I should probably clarify that. One orangutan has been observed applying a medicinal plant onto his wound.
Okay, are we going to need some more details? But like, so orangutans known to use other tools and that sort of thing? Is this like completely beyond their abilities? Like, what are we talking here?
Well, this has never been documented before.
Okay.
In any of the great apes to this extent. But as I'll talk about a little bit later, you know, primates and great apes do medicate in certain ways, self-medicate in certain ways. But this is a really new and sort of, I guess you'd sort of say, sophisticated way of doing it. You know where orangutans live. I mentioned one of the places in the introduction,
yeah.
Sumatra.
yeah, so much a place, but I also know them as Borneo. Is that kind of, yeah.
Very good. Yeah, yeah. So they're the largest tree-dwelling mammals, and they spend most of their time swinging from branch to branch. As you know, the males and the females, they look quite different. With the male orangutans, when they reach maturity, developing these beautiful, fleshy, melon-looking flanges on each side of their face. I think I did a story about that a few years back. But I have to say, I'm not just mentioning it because I like talking about the fleshy flange. You know, it's quite important to the story because this story begins with a male Sumatran orangutan whose name is Ruckus. Getting a sore on his face. So, yes, Ruckus, R-A-K-U-S.
Okay.
That's the orangutan's name. Found himself in an area without a dominant male. So, naturally, there was a bit of back and forth, a bit of argy-bargy with some of the other males. And after this argy-bargy, Ruckus ended up with a gash on his flanged face. Big old gash. And obviously wasn't very happy with this turn of events. He waited a couple of days and then decided to take matters into his own hands, quite literally. And he sought out a plant and found it. It's the Fibroria tinctoria, and it's also known as the Acar Kuning in Bahasa. So Ruckus chews the leaves into a frothy pulp. So finds it, chews the leaves, and then takes the chewed liquid, so just the liquid, and is documented in spreading this liquid all over the wound, the fleshy wound on his flange. And then, in addition to this, he then gets the mushy, chewed up leaf part, so not the liquid, but the, like, you know, the fibrous, cellulosey leafy bit, and then applies it, sort of like a pasty poultice type thing, onto his face, like a dressing, I guess you would call it. Yeah, directly onto the affected area. Now, it just so happens that when he did this, there was a team of researchers who were watching, and it was led by Dr. Isabel Lama, a Danish researcher, and her team, and they've just published the results of this in Scientific Reports. It's called Active Self-Treatment of a Facial Wound with a Biologically Active Plant by Male Sumatran Orangutan.
Wow. You know? So hang on. So, okay, you say biologically active plant. So is this plant known to have beneficial properties? Like, do the humans in the area use this plant as well?
Yes, the humans in the area use it. It isn't just any old jungle shrub. It is a plant of significant and known pharmaceutical quality. So it's found in tropical forests in Southeast Asia, and it's known for having analgesic properties, fever-reducing properties, diuretic effects. It's used in traditional medicine to treat various diseases, including dysentery, diabetes, and also malaria. And previous analysis of the plant show chemical compounds of, you know, these words that are incredibly difficult to say, to certain types of alkaloids, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, pretty much antibacterial, anti-inflammatory, antifungal, antioxidant, all the things that you would want if you had a large gaping wound on your flange.
Right.
So yeah, Ruckus, he was onto something, and you know, put this tincture on his face, and it worked. A couple of days later, you know, don't want to sound like, you know, someone on telly trying to sell you a product, but 3 days later, Ruckus had no wound on his face at all. You will not believe it, Chris.
I mean, it's a sample size of one orangutan. So from a medical point of view, I'm still, you know, going to be a little cautious to buy your jungle
What do you
shrub.
Mean? You're not going to go and get this miracle plant and smear it on yourself next time you've got an open wound? Chris.
If my flange gets into it, totally. But this is pretty remarkable, though, because like when humans use these kind of things, you know, often with traditional medicine, you know, people will be using, various plants and things. And it's lore. It's like passed down this knowledge in the culture. So does this suggest, I mean, what I'm saying is that Ruckus would have figured this out himself, or this is like a cultural thing that the orangutans know about this plant?
Well, that's a very good question. And as you said before, it's N equals one. We've only got one orangutan, and they haven't established a good family history with this orangutan to understand maybe where it's come from, where it's grown up, you know, what sort of cultural knowledge has been passed down, if any at all, or maybe this is just a total innovation that Ruckus has come up with himself.
Right.
So yeah, it's very much like a, but obviously he's doing it on purpose because.
Yeah, he went to quite lengths to do it.
He went to lengths. It didn't just fall onto his face.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It the whole thing has got me questioning. I'm like, are there any other instances of animals sort of self-medicating and healing themselves? And researchers, there's a bit of a hierarchy when it comes to sort of self-medication. So when it comes to animals, so there's your basic behaviors such as avoiding contaminated food or not eating when feeling unwell, and then there's more complex instances of self-medication, maybe eating foods that are proactively to keep you healthy. Mm. Or that can retroactively address an illness.
Dogs eating grass.
Dogs and cats eating grass. Yeah. Jane Goodall described chimps eating leaves and bitter pith, chewing bitter pith, and that was demonstrated to have therapeutic antiparasitic functions. So that they're sort of some of the self-medication that sort of research and understanding that we have of animals. But Ruckus's behavior it's very much a rarity in the animal kingdom. So an animal actually applying a plant to its body or its nest to benefit its health, and then actually seeing an animal treat itself with a plant that's known to have medicinal qualities is even more rare. So it's the first, as I said before, it's the first time that this has ever happened, which is pretty amazing. And as you say, like, you know, we don't know the intentionality of the behavior. They've been watching these orangutans in this part of Sumatra for a really long time, but they haven't seen anything like this before. So they're thinking, oh, well, maybe this is a new innovation. But then again, you know, they're not out there watching them 24/7. So yeah. Who knows?
And I guess if humans use it, it's potentially possible that they pick it up from watching humans as well.
Could be. Yeah. I don't know how close the human population is to this orangutan population.
Yeah.
Because it is quite a large reserve.
Sitting right next to a human. Yeah.
Peering through the windows.
What are they doing with that plant? Exactly. I'm going to remember that.
Exactly.
Next time I've got something on my flange.
The other interesting thing is this plant is also not a common part of the orangutan diet. So
that's the other thing I was wondering. Yeah,
that's the other thing. That it's the fact that Ruckus even went to it is remarkable, let alone turning it into a, you know, chewing it up, turning it into a poultice, applying it to his face, all the rest of it. So obviously we've got a lot more to learn about these incredible creatures probably a lot more to learn from Ruckus. And there's more innovation that's happening out in the world than just in the human arena. A profound reminder that ingenuity thrives throughout the animal kingdom.
Congratulations on your discovery, which may well prove to be among the most significant in the history of science.
I cannot accept half-baked theories that sell newspapers. I'm a scientist.
Who are you? Who are so wise in the ways of science?
A most distinguished scientist whose name we know, even in the wild of Transylvania.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you are listening to Lost in Science. If you have listened to the show long enough, you may recall that I am something of a fungi guy. The fungi are a pretty important kingdom of organisms, though, and we really don't know that much about them. The fungi were originally included in the plant kingdom basically because they didn't move and they seemed to have roots, but it doesn't, that's really, you know, underestimating the fungus as a group of organisms. They're not plants. They're in many ways more like animals, but they're not animals either. So they get their own kingdom, the fungi.
Oh, that's good. That's good because that means that there's mushroom to include them.
mushroom to improve the puns.
Don't sure. get yeah, too yeah. mycelia with the puns. Oh, that one didn't work.
Now, most of the time, we really only pay attention to the fungi when they cause us a problem. Either they make people sick, or they make animals sick, or they make plants sick, which we want the plants to do things for us, so we don't like them getting sick either. But the fungus I'm talking about tonight is not a pathogen of humans or animals or plants. It feeds on decaying wood like any good saprotroph, and it doesn't really cause much of a problem while it's doing that. And that's how it spends most of its time, just munching away on dead bits of wood. Now, this fungus or genus of fungi are known as Spherobolus, which basically translate as throwing ball.
Oh.
And sphere and is a sphere, and a bolus is to throw. But it's when they produce spores that they catch the attention of humans, and some might say fussy humans, but I'll explain why. So when the ball thrower fungus produces spores, they are dark, sticky, almost black little spheres, and that gives them one of their common names, which is cannonball fungus, because they kind of look like little tiny cannonballs. So the little cannonballs are not content to fall on the ground near the parent fungus. They are built for travel. They are built for spreading, which is the entire purpose of spores. And these ones spread very well. When they eject the spore-containing body, which is called a glebus, they can shoot that glebus over 6 meters, which is pretty far, considering we're talking about a fungus which is about 4 or 5 millimeters in height.
Oh, really? That's a very long way then, yeah.
It's a little tiny little thing, and it shoots this thing over 6 meters. And this is where one of the other common names for the fungus comes from. It's also known as artillery fungus, because it fires off these cannonballs like artillery. It shoots them all around. So the glebus is fired out of the fruiting body using osmotic pressure. We love a bit of osmotic pressure. So this is built up by the fungus. The fungus converts glycogen into glucose, which is a very simple sugar. The sugar increases the osmotic potential inside the spore-producing body, and it sucks in more water and makes the water pressure really, really high within the fruiting body, and then it shoots the little glebus out of the fruiting body. So it's a pretty amazing little process that it's got figured out here. Now, the fruiting bodies are full of sugar, so the little glebus is covered in sticky goo when it gets shot out, which allows it to stick to things, whatever happens to be around. It sticks onto surfaces like grass blades and leaves and fur and whatever happens to be around, which also helps spread the fungus around. The spores contained inside the glebus can survive for up to 12 years after they're ejected. So they can wait out long periods with no food source. They can pass through animal digestive tracts without damage. So they can, you know, land on a blade of grass, get eaten by a sheep or a cow or a kangaroo, whatever, and they move it around to somewhere else, and then it can sit around there and wait for the right time to grow.
And perhaps you've preempted my question, but how does it know it's the right time if it can sit around for 12 years?
Like most fungi, the conditions are right. So it's usually can detect that it's sitting on an appropriate food source, which in this case is dead bits of wood, which is kind of literally lying around all over the ground everywhere. It's not hard for it to find this kind of material. And then it's got to have enough moisture and the temperature's got to be right. So almost like a germinating seed, I suppose. They just sort of wake up and start munching. So under natural conditions, these tiny fungi have evolved to shoot their spores as far as possible away from standing plants and obstacles, and they shoot towards light. Now, I've tried to figure out how they know which direction the light's coming from, but they do seem to be able to sense the direction that brightness is coming towards the fungus, and they can shoot in that direction.
They have like eyes or something?
They have photosensitive cells or something, which is, you know, kind of a precursor to eyes. And there's obviously lots of different precursors to eyes, but fungi, I mean, there are the fungi that can swim around. So if they can swim around and see, then we're in serious trouble. So they have been recorded as being phototropic, and they've sort of measured this and put them in different environments, and they shoot towards the lightest color that they can perceive, or the direction of the light is probably more accurate to say. Now this is where humans come into the story. If the fungus is just out in the middle of a paddock or in the middle of a forest or something, wherever the light's coming from, it'll shoot towards that. If you've got a large reflective surface that's reflecting a lot of light, or a lot more than the ambient light from other directions, it will shoot towards that surface. So humans tend to build things like houses, and we surround the houses with things like gardens. Now, I've probably mentioned this once or twice, but one of the most common pieces of garden advice is to mulch your garden beds with organic matter. It helps suppress the weeds. It reduces the evaporation of water from bare soil. It makes the plants a lot happier. But one of the most common mulches people use is wood chips or mulch tree prunings, all kinds of dead bits of wood, which is what this fungus feeds on. So you put these garden beds all around your house with the mulch on top, and you get these spherobolous fungi growing on the mulch. And then when they produce their little glebi, they shoot them towards the lightest thing that they can detect, which is often the wall of the house. So if you think of weatherboard houses painted white and painted in these pale heritage colors and all this sort of thing, when the garden beds are right next to the house, then the weatherboards get covered in tiny little black specks, which, because they're so sticky, are very difficult to remove. And they also produce pigments in the, you know, in the fruiting body, which is still attached. And they stain things like paint, and they leave marks even if you do remove them, which is actually really hard. You have to use like pressure washing to get them off the surfaces. So this is where we have a problem. And the spores are very resilient. There's not really any way to kill them off. And basically, they're the inactive phase of the fungal life cycle anyway. So you're not really stopping the problem from happening if you spray them with something after they've already spat it all over your nice, clean, white walls. The fungus is growing in the mulch. So then you might think, well, why don't we apply some sort of fungicide to the mulch? Well, that will kill off not only these fungi, but all the other fungi, which are also breaking down the mulch. And you're basically arresting that decomposition cycle, which is kind of the reason that we put the mulch on in the first place. And there's a whole lot of other things. One of the things about most fungicides is that they're generally pretty toxic to other things as well, particularly invertebrates and worms and things like that. The fact that fungi are closely related to animals, even though they're not animals, means that a lot of things that are toxic to fungi are also toxic to animals. So we don't really want to go spraying fungicide just to stop these little black flecks from hitting the side of the wall. I've been reading that in the US, people are in litigation. I mean, when are they not in litigation in the US? Let's be honest about that. But, you know, litigation with their insurance companies, people are claiming insurance claims to get their weatherboards or their you know, paneled houses replaced because they're damaged by these fungus, and the insurance company saying, no, it's a natural process and we're not liable for it and all this sort of thing.
What are they saying? Like, oh, this fungus, it's like shooting cannonballs at my house. Like, how do you?
they wouldn't be prone to exaggeration, surely. But yeah, it's basically they're saying it's, you know, it's property damage, but this is, it's not something they can do anything about. There's not really a specific solution to the problem. You could probably avoid using wood chips as a mulch around your house, but you know, if they can throw them 6 meters, you're talking about quite long distances as well. There has been some research, you know, there's things that if you introduce, so you get mushroom compost from where they grow edible mushrooms in basically mushroom factories. You get that mushroom compost and mix that in with your mulch, and the other microbes in that tend to suppress the artillery fungus from producing spores, and there's all sorts of things. But I think probably the simplest solution is don't paint your house white, and it probably won't be a problem. They're attracted to the light surface. And, you know, it is interesting that in America that, you know, from what I've seen, they have a white house, but they don't seem that worried about whether it gets tarnished or not. They've put all sorts of things in it that weren't very good. But, yeah, look, basically, if you're going to have garden beds right up to your walls, maybe don't have white walls. Maybe go for, you know, darker bricks or something like that. See how you go. But there's not really any way to avoid these. They're everywhere. They're in every continent that's not frozen, basically. So I think we're just going to have to put up with them.
Well, I'm going to be looking for the telltale splashes of artillery fungus.
They're literally everywhere.
And that's all we have this week on another episode of Lost in Science. Thank you so much for joining us. Lost in Science is recorded on the lands of the Kulin Nations and the lands of the Jirringunj people, and is broadcast around Australia on the Community Radio Network with the kind support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. If you would like to get in touch with us, we would love to hear from you. You can find us at lostinsci@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook, where we are Lost in Science on 3CR. You can find us on all the best podcast places. Or you can tune in again next week, wherever you listen to Catriona, Claire, Chris, and Stu get Lost in Science.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.